This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, you! Yes, you! Don't go looking around like you don't know who I'm talking to. Do you not understand your place in the American economy? It's not hard. You spend. That's all you have to do. Because if you don't, well, then we get days like this. When a company like Walmart says its sales last month were the worst they've been in 27 years. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 10th of May today. This one's a Thursday. Good to have you here. I'm sorry to have pointed the finger right at you, but the retail sales numbers out today were some of the worst ever. Taken together, major retailers reported a 2.3% decline in same-store sales over last year. Walmart, as I mentioned, reported its worst drop on record, 3.5%. Ashley Miltite reports now on gas prices and the rest of the usual suspects.
April showers and chilly temperatures in some parts of the country dampened shoppers' zeal. TNS retail forward economist Frank Badillo says this April looks especially bad because sales a year ago were so strong. But because Easter came early in March this year, many shoppers hit the malls then. Still, he says the news isn't bad across the board.
Some of these retailers that serve upper-income households, they continue to do well because those are the households that are continuing to benefit from the job and income gains in the economy.
Whereas he says Walmart shoppers are hurt by high gas prices. But retail analyst Brad Stevens of Morgan Keegan doesn't buy the gas price theory. He says the chain's focus on apparel just isn't working.
When you walk into a Target, you see a very clean, very organized presentation. In Walmart, it looks like sometimes it's been shot out of a shotgun.
That said, Target saw April sales drop too. Stephen says if May turns out to be a shopping washout, retailer stocks will take a hit. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The United Nations estimates that every month more than 50,000 Iraqis are displaced by the war, more than 4 million refugees in all. So far, just a handful have been allowed to come to the United States. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports some in Congress would like to change that.
Terrence Sims is a former Army officer who served 15 months in Iraq. It wasn't long before he noticed the high rate of assassinations of native translators and drivers working for the Americans.
These interpreters and contractors, the guys who work on the camps, they're still going home at night. For all intents and purposes, they're living next door to the bad guys. Themselves as well as their family members are constantly being intimidated for the fact that they're working with us.
For their own protection, thousands of Iraqis with ties to American forces have been fleeing their country. Many would like to come to the U.S., but Oregon Democratic Representative Earl Blumenauer says not many can.
Over the last 6 months, we have allowed only 69 Iraqis into the country, only one in the month of April.
Congressman Blumenauer today introduced a bill to allow 60,000 Iraqis who've worked for coalition forces and their families to be resettled in the U.S. over the next 4 years. The bill would also nearly triple the number of general visas for Iraqis this year and next. Mark Krikorian at the Center for Immigration Studies, which favors tighter controls on immigration, admits the U.S. has an obligation. However, he has a security concern.
We need to do a very good job of screening these people for their backgrounds. Otherwise, we take in people and they create an incubator for anti-American sentiment.
Krikorian is reminded of the refugees created by the Vietnam War and warns it's a consequence of foreign entanglements. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Chinese ambassador and the head of the Food and Drug Administration made the rounds of Congress today. Lawmakers have been calling for closer import inspections as the contaminated pet food scandal has spread. U.S. food producers are all in favor of a tougher tone with foreign counterparts. So we asked Marketplace's Steve Tripoli to look into whether their motives are entirely unadulterated.
American poultry producers are jumping all over a proposal to let Chinese chicken into the U.S. Two catfish farming states recently banned Chinese catfish found to contain forbidden antibiotics, and a flood of stories about dangerous practices abroad feeds the fire. So concerns are legitimate, but Carol Tucker Foreman at the Consumer Federation of America says that doesn't mean there isn't a whiff of protectionism in U.S. producers' complaints.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time. On the other hand, we do have to have a system that gives us the ability to go into those countries and check the adequacy of their food inspection.
Gene Kinsey at the University of Minnesota's Food Industry Center says calls for a crackdown are hard to ignore because the extent of problems abroad remains a question mark.
The answer is no, we don't know how much of it is going on. The only way we would know how it's really going on is to do a lot of investigative work and testing of product that is coming into this country.
Kinsey agrees that some of the hollering from here may be unwarranted, but she says that since U.S. producers often make food under specific brand labels, they have a big stake in knowing what's coming into their plants and new responsibilities, too.
The people importing it have to be better at testing what they're getting and developing a stronger international protocol for tracking and tracing the food that comes through the supply chain.
Kinsey and Foreman both say there's a long way to go in making the global market in food products more transparent. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
No new records on Wall Street today. Barely an up arrow at all, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a neat bit of economic and political symmetry in England today. As Prime Minister Tony Blair was announcing the date of his departure from office, the Bank of England was raising interest rates. Blair will step down on June 27th after 10 years in power. British interest rates, meanwhile, are at their highest point in 6 years, in part because of inflation that critics blame on Blair's policies. The Prime Minister talked about his legacy today. He acknowledged Iraq had been bitterly controversial, but he claimed his handling of the British economy had been one of his major successes. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard looks back.
10 years ago, Tony Blair swept into office, buoyed up by a massive victory at the polls and brimming over with optimism.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
His campaign rallies had pulsated with a theme song, the anthem of his early years in power, Things Can Only Get Better. Ten years on, as Blair heads for the exit, the verdict of many economists is that things have gotten better.
Gross domestic product has grown at an average rate of about 2.8%, which is rather stronger than we saw in the previous 10 years.
Jonathan Loynes of Capital Economics says under Blair, general economic conditions have improved.
Unemployment has been falling steadily over that period, and we've seen pretty low rates of inflation. So I think overall the economy is in pretty good shape.
But few Brits seem prepared to thank Tony Blair. According to opinion polls, most people feel that his finance chief, Gordon Brown, has been the main architect of whatever economic success Britain has seen.
I am better off, but I wouldn't put that to Blair's credit.
It's been sort of Gordon Brown, you know, at the sort of helm. The economy has improved under Blair, but I think it's all been down, you know, due to Gordon Brown.
Then there's the question of relative prosperity. Average weekly pay in Britain has risen by 71% over the past decade. But as in the United States, income inequality has risen too. The rich have got very much richer. Many people on average incomes don't feel much better off after 10 years of Tony Blair.
Economically speaking, I would say a definite no, but that may be just my personal circumstances.
Swings and roundabouts. I know I'm better off, but I don't feel it.
There's clearly been lots of wealth generation, but whether it's equally distributed is, I think, a very different issue.
I'll light the fire.
But there's another more fundamental problem with Blair's economic legacy. The good times, such as they are, may not last much longer. Much of the economic growth of the past decade, say the critics, has been built on a shaky foundation. The average price of a house has tripled since Blair took power. Opposition economic spokesman Vince Cable calls this a dangerous bubble.
If it does burst, the problem is that a lot of people on mortgages are in potentially very exposed. To get on the housing ladder now, you borrow five times your income in many parts of the country. So any downturn in the economy and any weakening of the housing market puts those people in great difficulty.
This spoof song from the 1990s has been reprised and is doing the rounds on the internet, raising the spectre of a housing collapse.
Our house. In the middle of a slump, our house. No one wants to buy this dump.
But it must be said, the doom-mongers have been forecasting a property collapse for years. For Tony Blair, as he heads away from the cares of office and into multi-million dollar book deals and lecture tours, there is only one safe prediction. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The White House gave at least a nod to negotiating with Congress today over that Iraq War funding bill. The president said benchmarks for progress might not be such a bad thing after all. The House has come up with a $43 billion package it wants to send the president, but he's already said he'll veto it because the funding runs out in July. In his new book about the history of how America pays for its wars, Goldman Sachs Vice Chairman Robert Hormats points out that nobody's paying attention to where that money's coming from. It's borrowed, and both Congress and the White House are sidestepping their obligations to pay back their debts. Bob Hormats, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let me cast the long look backwards at history and ask you about the drive that our national leaders have had in almost every war up until the present case to eliminate the debt caused by funding that war in the military, some degree of expediency, right?
Absolutely. It was a fundamental tenet of U.S. policy from the Revolution through about the early 1960s that when you accumulated debt to pay for a war, which was the case in every war in our history, you also worked very hard after the war to pay down that debt. George Washington, in his famous farewell address, said that Americans should not ungenerously, as he put it, throw debt upon the next generation that they themselves ought to be paying off. Jefferson believed this. After the Civil War, a major effort was made to pay down the enormous Civil War debt. The same was done after World War I. And even after World War II, a lot of the debt was paid down relatively quickly.
Well, then what happened in the 1960s?
In the 1960s, we became used to big deficits. They didn't seem to matter to Americans. And in the Vietnam War in particular, there was not the sense that we had an obligation to finance the war in a fiscally responsible way. And I think up until very recently, there has been the view that somehow war debts, first of all, would be relatively small because it was anticipated the Iraq war would be short and cheap, although it turned out not to be, but also that somehow growth would bail us out, that we wouldn't have to make any sacrifice. We wouldn't have to cut back on other domestic programs to make room in the budget for the military. And that has worked temporarily, but it's not a permanent solution. You can't always rely on that.
Give me the subjective answer here. Has U.S. national security been improved or harmed by the way we're financing the war in Iraq and the war on terror?
I think national security today is more vulnerable because of the way we have financed the war in Iraq and the war on terror. In the following sense, first of all, it's important to level with the American people about the costs of national security. In so doing, you bring the American people along, you give them a better sense of what's required, you help to mobilize support for national security spending. Second, going forward with appropriations through the supplemental process in a way skirts the budget process, so it means you don't have to set priorities. It means you just put this additional money in without making reallocations within the budget among various programs. Third is that we're going to be going into a decade in which almost certainly the budget deficit is going to mushroom. It means that there will be less flexibility in the budget to finance national emergencies, and those big budget deficits will balloon even further if there's a terrorist attack because revenues will decline, and we will then have a very serious fiscal problem, and that could push up interest rates further and further weaken the economy.
The book by Bob Hormats on how America finances its national security is called The Price of Liberty. Bob Hormats is a vice chairman at Goldman Sachs International. Mr. Hormats, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, Control-Alt-Delete to keep your job.
I needed to know what the computer was capable of doing. I didn't even realize there was an undo button for mistakes. And I learned how to use that very well.
But first, let's do the numbers. Disappointing economic reports brought Wall Street back down to terra firma today. The Dow Industrials took a 147-point nosedive, down 1.1%, finished the day at 13,215. The Nasdaq plunged 42 points, 1.2%, ending at 2,533. The S&P 500 dove 21 points, that's 1.4%, to end at 1,491. A penny saved is most definitely not a penny earned for the retail sector. Clothing retailers were riding low today. Gap slouched 0.8% after it announced an 11% drop in April sales. Federated Department Store zipped down nearly 4% after it said sales were looking a little skimpy. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, President Bush participates in a ceremony honoring the husbands and wives of those in the armed forces on Military Spouses Day. The Commerce Department reports on business inventories for March and retail sales for April. And modern dance pioneer Martha Graham was born on May 11, 1894. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We hear about companies paying fines all the time, so often that some of us get jaded unless the headline calls it a record. Usually the second line of that story is something about the company in question not admitting guilt. So the news about the makers of the powerful painkiller OxyContin today was a surprise. Purdue Pharma and three top executives of the company admitted they lied about the drug's addiction risks, and collectively they'll pay more than $600 million in fines. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer has more.
OxyContin's formulated as a long-lasting painkiller, but chewing it or crushing and injecting it can create a heroin-like high. The drug's maker, Purdue Pharma, knew there was potential for abuse, but pushed it aggressively anyway, says attorney John Brownlee.
They continued to push a fraudulent marketing campaign that promoted OxyContin as being less addictive, less subject to abuse, and less likely to cause withdrawal.
Brownlee's the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Virginia. He says the $634 million-plus in fines will punish Purdue's wrongdoing and help compensate some of the people harmed by OxyContin who've sued the company.
We've had them set aside $130 million so that they can pay these civil claims that they either lose or they decide to settle.
Plaintiffs' attorneys say this guilty plea will make OxyContin cases easier to win, so many will continue. Meanwhile, some argue Purdue's getting off lightly. Alex Sugarman-Brosen of the consumer group Prescription Access Litigation.
The effects are lingering, and there's also a question of whether even this $635 million sufficiently addresses the harm that was done, or whether they can chalk it up as a cost of doing business.
Since 2000, OxyContin's retail sales in the U.S. were $9.6 billion. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
There are two things you can mention to almost any CEO in this country that will provoke an immediate response. One's global warming and how to balance protecting the environment with protecting the economy. The other's healthcare and how companies can protect their bottom lines. Safeway CEO Steve Bird launched a healthcare reform effort this week. Bird and three dozen other Fortune 500 CEOs are calling for a market solution. Commentator and consumer advocate Jamie Court says that's great, but the market's the problem.
Some of the biggest names on the Fortune 500 say they want market forces to fix the problem of high healthcare costs. So they support the government making every American buy health insurance. The irony is that if insurers had made health insurance affordable and available, we wouldn't need the heavy hand of government to force individuals to buy policies. The likes of Safeway, PepsiCo, General Mills, and Pacific Gas and Electric don't have a plan to effectively rein in healthcare costs. They don't do anything about the inefficiency and profiteering of drug makers or health insurers whose premiums have risen 250% more quickly than the rate of medical inflation. That's probably because insurers Aetna, Cigna Healthcare, PacifiCare, and drug maker Eli Lilly are part of the Safeway Coalition, too. If the employers don't want to pay premiums, fine. They should just admit the market doesn't work and turn the job over to the government by expanding Medicare. That's how it's done in the rest of the industrialized world, where there's far more efficiency. The World Health Organization ranked the USA 37th of 191 countries for overall health system performance, 72nd for level of health, and first for health expenditures per capita. And there's no way that mandatory health insurance is going to help those numbers. Real universal health care means getting every patient access to doctors, hospitals, and prescription drugs whenever they need it so that sick patients don't get sicker. And that saves money. Instead, these companies back turning government into a collections agent for private insurers. That leaves American citizens bearing the burden of big costs and high deductible insurance policies that discourage early treatment. That's not reform. It's a bailout for insurers and drug companies that refuse to be accountable for the high prices they charge and the paltry health care they provide.
Jamie Courts, the president of the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights. What do you think? Tell us at marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve said it's still worried about inflation. Today, it was those retail sales numbers we started with and a report that the trade deficit's growing, none of which is good news for the economy, which in turn isn't good news for people looking for jobs.
The most recent unemployment report showed more than 500,000 people have simply left the workforce and that the ranks of discouraged job seekers continues to grow. Marketplace's Hillary Wakay has our story.
For nearly a decade, 48-year-old Teresa Gaylor worked in a manufacturing plant in North Carolina. She watched as younger people got promoted over her. They had computer skills she didn't have. Even many manufacturing jobs today require knowledge of spreadsheets and data entry.
All of a sudden, you're thrown in this group of people that have all this education, and you're getting pushed out of your job. And that's difficult. It's hard to take. It's depressing. You don't understand why your years of experience don't speak for something.
Gaylor says she felt a layoff was imminent. She's witnessed cutbacks firsthand. In 2003, when the textile company Pillowtex closed, her community, Kannapolis, North Carolina, experienced the largest layoff in the state's history. 7,000 workers lost their jobs. The federal government poured millions into the local community college system, but many of the new students didn't know how to use a computer and couldn't make it through those classes. Ed Hosack lost his job at Pillowtex.
Many of the individuals who came out of the mill were very discouraged. They approached the community college, and maybe they took some of the courses and found themselves overwhelmed and simply backed away and in some ways gave up.
The former general manager wanted to do something to help out the manufacturing workers in the area. So Hosack started Life Builder Ministries and opened a classroom to teach the most basic computer skills, like how to turn it on and use programs like Microsoft Word. His classes quickly filled. 4 years later, he's still getting some former Pillowtex employees, but now workers from other plants who've been laid off or folks like Teresa Gaylor who feel a layoff coming, even retirees sign up. Volunteer instructors ease the students through.
Now, most of you know what this little guy's called, right?
Mouse.
Right? Why? Because it's got a tail. Right?
Gaylor took the basic skills she learned and got an office assistant job at the local school district in January.
I needed to know what the computer was capable of doing. I didn't even realize there was an undo button for mistakes. And I learned how to use that very well.
Software giant Microsoft estimates more than 77% of U.S. jobs will require some computer skills by 2010. But the company also estimates about a third of all adults today don't have those skills. That's part of why Microsoft has donated $255 million to 800 community projects like Life Builder. Pamela Passman of Microsoft admits this grassroots idea is new to a company that's used to a high-volume, low-cost approach when tackling business problems.
So in many ways, it's a fairly inefficient way because we're engaging one-on-one. We really want to be able to reach large segments of these populations. But the most impactful way we found to do it is to work with those organizations most critical in their communities.
It may not be efficient, but former Life Builder students like Shirley Harkey say the classes make a next step seem possible.
I had no confidence in me at all. I had lost that.
Now she helps teach the Life Builder computer classes and is taking additional community college courses she hopes will help her get office work. Teachers and students in the classes all say it's hard to put a value on the hope that's restored just by learning computer basics.
The on button is usually used to turn it on. However, you very rarely use that button to turn them off.
In Kannapolis, North Carolina, I'm Hillary Wakay for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, Pasadena, California is about 15 minutes up the freeway from our studios here in downtown. It has its own newspaper and a separate news website called PasadenaNow.com. But the news on that site won't come from reporters in Pasadena. The news has been outsourced to India. The site's publisher says he understands it sounds strange, but city council meetings are streamed now over the web, and most sources are just a phone call away. So he said it made sense to hire cheap English-speaking labor in India. In his words, more news for less money. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media, at least for now, produced in Los Angeles. Bad day for the markets today in New York. The Dow down 147 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ dropped 42 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 stumbled down 21 points, 1.4%. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, the tricky business of campaign finance laws.
The federal system is so convoluted that I haven't met a reporter in 10 years that understood the law.
All right, so we're going to give it a shot. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.